Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. We are now several months into the Trump administration, and activists have scored some important victories in those months. Yet there's always more to be done, and for many people, the question of where to focus and how to help remains. In this series, we talk with organizers, agitators, and educators, not only about how to resist, but how to build a better world. I'm Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Patrick Blanchfield. I'm a freelance journalist and writer, and who writes about violence and guns and in American culture and politics, and I'm also an associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. So we had talked before we got on this call about how hard it is to actually have a discussion about guns and gun violence and mass shootings in the framework of sort of resistance. And so to start off with, I thought I would ask you a somewhat open-ended question about the discourse that happened after these mass shootings and the political demands that are sort of assumed on both sides, or maybe not on both sides, but like the lack of political demands on one side and the political demands that are sort of assumed by people to the left of center.
Sure. I think the thing that's really striking to me in the wake of all these mass shootings is how, I've been doing this for many years now, is realizing how much of what people articulate as their immediate political desires are really about just like, this is what I would like the world to be otherwise. Right? Like, I would like to have a world in which this doesn't happen. Like, I would like to have a world in which no gun violence. And it's, and there's a temptation in that space to immediately endorse certain policy propositions, or rather, you're so wedded to that outcome that people who are otherwise very self-reflective leftists wind up sounding a lot like proceduralist law enforcement national security Democrats, or even quote-unquote moderate Republicans. And so the thing, if we want to frame this in terms of resistance, what I think the way to think about resistance and gun violence that's the most sort of like helpful is to actually resist the immediate framing of it and try and come up with a different handle on it.
Yeah, and that's a really tough thing because, you know, we are unfortunately, horrifically sort of used to these things happening now. And we know the political sort of spots we're supposed to fall into, and people tend to talk as if there is like a fully sort of fleshed out quote unquote gun control framework that is only being held up by a Republican majority in Congress or something like that, or only being held up by NRA donations. We don't actually have that at all.
That's exactly right. I mean, like, there is some way in which, like, again, like, it's immensely emotionally satisfying to, for example, and necessary politically, right, to see when liberal journalists share, you know, such and such a congressman got $10,000 last year from the NRA, such and such a congressman got 15. And that's dispositive of how corrupt our, the character of regulatory capture, like, our system is. But on another level, if that were all that was at play, then, and also, it's not a lot of money, right? That's a couple dinners at a D.C. steakhouse. The answer would just be like, give that same congressman or congresswoman $12,000. Give them $16,000. Just outbid the NRA. But clearly something else is going on, because that's not happening. And even if you were to have that money, and there are anti-gun forces out there that are fairly well money, they're not doing that. It doesn't seem to work.
Yeah.
So the trick is to have
Yeah, and one of those people who is ostensibly sort of in this gun control space is Michael Bloomberg, who is the mayor of New York under the stop and frisk regime that, you know, was ostensibly, again, about guns. That the whole justification for a racist stop and frisk policy by the New York Police Department was to find guns. And, you know, so Michael Bloomberg has literally all the money. He's like the 12th richest person in the world or something like that. He could easily buy some congressmen if it was about money. But the policies that he would put forward as quote-unquote gun control, again, are concerning, to say the least.
That's exactly right. And so, like, what I'm sort of begging our leftist audience to sort of do, and like, is to, or rather, there's a way in which, like, the moment guns enter the mix, people have this immediate, like, aversive or really enthusiastic response one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And people, and actually that's actually been documented by psychologists, right? Like, I hold up
right.
a photo of a gun in a cognitive psych lab. People are going to have a reaction. It's going to be one way or another. And then they may later describe it as one way, as something, but they're
mm-hmm.
going to have, like, their pulse is going to rise. They're going to have these various strong, it's a super overcoated object. Even saying the word does stuff to people. And
yeah.
the thing is, we have to, particularly, there are a lot of us who have very sophisticated politics about things like policing, about things like misogynistic violence, about things like violence perpetuated against like sexual and gender minorities, right? And the trick is to understand that the phenomenon in the landscape of gun violence is a organic continuation of the broader landscape of other kinds of violence in this country. And
yes.
just because guns are in the mix doesn't mean that we should suddenly endorse carceral solutions that we wouldn't for other things, right?
Yes.
And so the trick is to not fall into the trap of that immediate desire for a knee-jerk response.
Yeah, and, you know, we have this conversation now, and I was in Iowa giving a talk yesterday and sort of ended up talking about journalism, but ended up talking about this issue as an example over and over again, that, like, we've gotten to the point where, like, just a regular old mass shooting, which I think is four or more people, isn't even spectacular enough to get national news coverage anymore. It has to be something like this thing in Las Vegas, which is literally, you know, the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. We only have these conversations, it seems, and we're not really having a conversation. I guess we're having a sort of, like, war of statements. But we only have any of this when there's something so horrific that people feel forced to respond.
Yeah, exactly. And there's something like, the thing, I think that, like, that's also worth bearing in mind, right, is exactly like two concepts that I want to, like, to have people feel more, like, intellectually limber about, but also, like, capable of sort of thinking their own way through emotionally are gun violence on the one hand and mass shootings on the other, right?
Yeah.
And, you oftentimes see in mainstream media, liberal or otherwise, statements about gun violence or mass shootings, or data, even numbers about both those things, that if
yeah.
you push at them will reveal some really striking agenda-driven political sort of blank spots or omissions. To take one really
mm-hmm.
good example, there are a lot of people, a lot of journalists who will cite figures on gun homicide that exclude killings by police, which, again,
yeah.
seems to be a problem. Or another thing, and this is another thing, like, really, really, I want to beg everyone to walk away from embracing a knee-jerk way. What are the benchmarks that we apply to what the U.S. should be like? And you frequently see people say, well, the U.S. shouldn't be anything like other OECD developed nations or wealthy nations. And oftentimes those sample sets, and you'll see very illustrative graphs, will show a really marked gap between, like, the U.S. and Scandinavia. But tellingly,
right.
they always exclude Mexico, which is an OECD
right.
developed state and which gets most of its guns from us, right? So the question is, like,
yeah.
what are we obscuring by, and what are we gaining politically by comparing ourselves to states that we don't really resemble versus ones that we actually really do? And the answer is a type of erasure of the real political asymmetries of power and racial difference in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very interesting. Because we use those same metrics, the same sort of comparisons when we're talking about healthcare, which is obviously incredibly relevant when talking about gun violence and gun deaths. And we'll come back to that, I'm sure, several times in this conversation. But we use those same references to sort of, you know, Western European countries when talking about healthcare systems that we also don't have.
For sure, like basically states like and like states that are not fairly that have a much higher standard of living overall, that have a much lower index of inequality, that don't have the anywhere near resembling the same sort of cyclical problems that are produced by a revolving door prison apparatus, that don't have massive underground economies like, you know, the drug market, which is basically only enforced by us and the states and not by, like, so when we, there's an odd way in which we keep on wanting to be something other than what we are rather than looking at what we actually are and can't be. And that gap is, I think, present in the gun debate in a way that it is in healthcare is probably the other example, but I'm hard-pressed to think of any other sort of domain of public discourse where we look to these benchmarks that are nothing like what we are. And I haven't think the political dividend is just to erase the realities of inequality and violence that we otherwise are very aware of.
Right. Yeah, and it, the piece that you wrote at N+1 in response to this latest mass shooting was sort of to point out that the thing about mass shootings that is horrifying to the average person who doesn't have to worry about the sort of more everyday gun violence that happens in a lot of places, this is the moment where it is sort of equal, right? When there is a random person shooting random people on the street, then there is nothing in our various systems of inequality that can protect you.
Precisely. And that's the and this actually goes even to the definition of this definition that I want us to like tease apart. The definition of mass shooting itself is a moving target. Right, depending on if you, for example, you ask the FBI what constitutes a mass shooting, I think it's 3 or 4 more people are killed in a single setting by one shooter.
Yeah.
But if you were to ask a newscaster, you know, a well-intentioned person, not necessarily someone who's deeply cynical, they'd tell you it's a spree shooting in a church or a school or a college campus or a business park, right? And there's a way in which mass shooting then becomes as a, and so what that means practically speaking is that even from, is that from a certain standpoint, if you have like 17 people shot in 15 minutes, none fatally, in a block party in New Orleans, this happened 2 or 3 years ago, that is, quote unquote, technically speaking, not a mass shooting. Right?
Yeah.
And it's certainly not a mass shooting that's reported as such in the mainstream media.
Right. Yeah.
So the question then becomes, like, how do we think about this other category of gun violence in a way that accommodates these spectacular acts of violence, you know, as in Vegas, as in Sandy Hook, as in so many other places, but that also doesn't take them as a radical exception from a norm just because they happen more often than not to involve white people or wealthy people or people who, quote unquote, and this is the implicit logic, shouldn't expect to get shot.
So I'm literally, we're having this conversation. I'm in the Chicago airport right now. And, you know, Trump has used Chicago in particular, and obviously, like, Chicago has a racialized connection to President Obama, but it also is his sort of example of a horrifically violent place that has a lot of guns. And his response to that, which is an applause line at, you know, his ongoing campaign rallies, is to, like, threaten to send in the police, or send in the military. And so, you know, we see this kind of response regularly to the idea of gun violence from, you know, from Trump, but also from, you know, Democrats who run cities like St. Louis, which is ongoing, undergoing another round of protests that have been really undercovered right now. This idea that, like, you know, the response to regular, quote-unquote, regular gun violence is to just, like, arm the cops more. And then the response to spectacular mass shootings is we need gun control.
Yeah. And that's sort of the it's a weird cognitive dissonance because, again, people who are otherwise extremely intellectually sophisticated vis-a-vis things like the war on drugs or just occupation-style policing will not seem to question, you know, who is going to be going door to door collecting the guns if we want to do an Australian style buyback, which of course we'd never do. But like,
right.
if you want to take away all the guns, what's the mechanism? And I'm not talking here, like, I'm not trying to bog us down in the policy. We're just being like,
yeah, no.
Do we actually think that the enforcement of that will not in and of itself partake of the same sort of horrible injustices and unnecessary violence that our other
right.
mechanisms of enforcement do. The literature frequently talks about, there are frequently comparisons that are drawn in a lot of the literature and scholarly literature between guns and drugs insofar as that guns, like a lot of drugs, are things that people quote-unquote feel passionately about is the phrase you encounter, but also that are small and easy to conceal, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just thinking about it materially like that, you're like, oh, this is going to mean searches of people's homes. And when you consider how easily a lot of
yeah.
people co-signed, as you said, Bloomberg Stop and Frisk just because
yeah.
it was guns. I think in
right.
the context, if we said we're just going to stop black people because they may have drugs, so a lot of those liberals are like, no. But it's because it's
yeah.
guns. Suddenly we're like, okay, we'll do it. Go for it. And,
yeah.
you know, happens, right?
Right, and it's you know, we saw John Lewis, like of all Congress people, John Lewis leading this sort of sit-in on the floor of the House for including, you know, no-fly list data in, you know, gun background checks or whatever it was. You can explain exactly what it was better than I can.
No, yeah, it was a no-fly list, like a no-fly, no-buy, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just, so at the point in which, like, you know, like, that basically means that if you're in any of several highly opaque and incredibly faulty and constantly metastasizing government databases.
And racist.
You can't fly and you can't buy a gun and just, I have profound respect for, but it is one of those points where I'm like,
yeah.
is this the best that we could hope for, which is namely quote unquote gun control that basically is just another vector for expanding the security state. I think the job of leftists is to demand for something other than that.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I was in a hotel for the last couple of days. So I was reading the USA Today that, you know, you get free in the hotel. And they had interviews with the people at the gun shop that the guy in Vegas bought his guns from. And they were like, yeah, he passed the background check. He had never had any, you know, criminal offenses. And you think about, like, the most common predictor for this kind of gun violence is domestic violence, which is one of the least likely to be reported violent crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Violent crimes with big air quotes around it. But you know what I mean, right? That, like, the... When we're talking about a warning sign like domestic violence that is just highly likely to be not reported to the police in the first place, that would not show up on a background check of a lot of people, you know, we have this question of, like, background checks. Okay, people are talking about background checks. Background checks has got to be the thing. This guy passed them all with flying colors.
Mm-hmm. And we're hearing now from his partner several, like, I don't know if you saw the article just that were coming out this morning before she had flown back from abroad, like, they
mm-hmm.
would, people doing, like, shoe leather reporting went to the local Starbucks where they got coffee, and they were like, immediately, oh yeah, he's the guy who treated his partner like trash every morning. And so, like, this goes to that point where it's like, gun violence, whether it be mass shootings or partner murder, is on an organic continuum with other kinds of violence in society. And a way to think about it is that if we want to think about, like, what guns do in those spaces that are already saturated with violence, is they basically precipitate or accelerate lethal outcomes. And so whatever our politics are going to be in terms of our responses to gun violence as a category, it has to be coherent alongside our consciousness of those other kinds, broader kinds of violence, rather than just trading one kind of violence for another. Because Lord knows it's not like police don't have a problem with domestic violence in their homes. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things, we were talking about money a little bit earlier, and one of the things that you were watching on the day of this in Las Vegas was, of course, the gun stocks going up.
Yep. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I wonder if you could talk about sort of why you started watching that, but also that that part of this whole equation.
Yeah, so it's like, it's, and this again points to that broader, that theme where it's like this type of violence and this type of culture of violence is related to broader cultures and broader structures of violence. Arms as an industry more broadly thrives on people using arms.
When
I think this is another thing too that a lot of specifically white liberals should not view with contempt. When people feel unsafe, when there is the possibility of physical harm coming to you, and particularly when you can't trust the authorities to vindicate your own desire for safety, and that the authorities may be a source of threat, people make decisions that, from the perspective of those who are more secure, may seem foolish. They may arm themselves. They may choose to arm themselves. But the reality is that from in that space, I have a very hard time begrudging them for making that choice. And
yeah.
So, yes, the desire to, like, be the person who pulls a gun on a mass shooter and save yourself is belied by reams of data that say, you know, that's not going to work, you're only going to get killed by cops, etc. But people are still in this hard spot where they have to make a choice, and so they buy guns. And there is a way in which the arms industry, which exists thanks in no small part to a lot of federal government subsidies, we should say, caters to that, but there is also a way in which simply focusing on the manufacturers, which reap an outrageous profit, or focusing on the NRA, occludes the fact that people are buying their product regardless of the Byzantine politics of lobbying or the like, the subliminal messaging of ads, etc. They're doing it because they feel unsafe, and unless we have a politics that it can address those material and emotional conditions of unsafety, people are still going to be buying guns, and it's kind of hard to blame them.
Yeah, and this is all, it gets around to the question that we sort of keep bringing up, and we haven't talked at all about men, but I guess we should probably talk about men. We broadly don't have a society that makes people feel safe and protected. And obviously, as we mentioned a little bit about domestic violence, and I think, you know, it's worth noting, as we say, that, you know, most of these mass shooters are men of various backgrounds and ethnicities and whatever. But when we talk about that, those things sort of point to, like, the bigger, scarier social questions that we have to grapple with on a level that doesn't have a bill we can pass through Congress to abolish patriarchy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish we could, but I don't think we can.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Well, so one of the things I do is I just read a lot of gun-centered publications, I read a lot of industry materials, and I read a lot of the scholarly lit, and there is, it's striking how, like, super gendered it all is. And there is a way, you know, and I'll cape for, like, psychoanalysis and, like, Freudian, and kind of, like, suffered, like, to the end of my days. And it seems, like, crude to say that for a certain sector of the populace, guns are, you know, like, just their big penises. But then you hear what people had to say about Hillary Clinton and what they wanted to do to her with their guns. And I won't get granular enough, but there were a lot of talk radio hosts who said some things that you're like, oh, okay, that really is a penis. Or you read, you see an ad from, like, Bushmaster just prior to the Sandy Hook shooting, and the ad was very literally like, get your man card back, buy an AR-15. And if that were in a shitty satirical novel, you couldn't have a more on the nose, hey men, do you feel castrated? Here, this buying this gun will remasculinize you. My favorite
was the politician who had the bacon on the gun barrel, and I don't remember who it was.
Ted Cruz.
It was Ted Cruz.
Yeah, it was Ted Cruz. It was like the image of like of Ted Cruz's like blobfish face eating steaming bacon off the barrel of like a fully automatic machine gun is just like the sizzling and the grease is going to haunt me to the rest of my days. Like, and the thing is, like, this implicates, for example, a lot of the discourse on the left where it's like, well, we just need sufficiently militantly armed leftists. And I'm like, okay, maybe we do, and I'd be happy to talk about the role of weapons in leftist organizing over the past century, and that's not something to be diminished. But on another level, that's not a solution because I have yet to see a single study that say that leftist men are less likely to shoot their partners. And so, like, we have to do that too.
And so, you know, so we've been talking a lot about what doesn't work and which solutions are sort of too easy to reach for in these moments. So I do want to turn to questions of what can be done, because I think rightly in moments like this, a lot of people are like, we need to do something. And they want to do something, and I don't want that to be support whatever Michael Bloomberg is selling this week.
No, for sure.
So what are some of the things that you have been covering, that you've talked to, that you've, you know, seen, that are doing something that seems positive about the broad issue of guns and violence and healthcare and safety in America?
So the big theme, right, is this two part. One is just like resist the frame. Like the Democratic Party does not need you to support expanding the no-fly list in order to give the NRA what it deserves. The Democratic Party can take care of that themselves. They'll keep doing it. Like that's the one thing that they'll do is sit in for. They're willing to go to bat for it. Instead even of like getting psyched about they're falling into the wormhole of like gun control debates on the national level, think about gun death on the local level. Get local, think about what groups, who in your community is the most vulnerable to winding up dead because of a bullet. And when you start asking that question, you see across the country some really surprising grassroots coalitions coming into being or being operative for some time that are doing really substantive things that are helping lower that toll of violence. Now, this is, by the way, so I'll talk about that in another one. Like, there is a point here there, which like some national voting, calling a senator stuff does matter. But like,
yeah,
in terms of local stuff that's happening, like, a lot of this depends upon where you, and this implicates two things. One is like, where is the activism happening? And two, what's the room for actual interventions that are meaningful, right? And the simple character of how, I won't get into the grand, like two inside baseball, but the way in which gun laws have taken shape, particularly over the last 30 or 40 years, means that most interventions that are meaningful are happening on the state or even more often municipal levels.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's legislatively, but also in terms of activism, such that, to give some examples, if you're in a place like Chicago or Louisville or St. Louis or any of numerous municipalities where the major driver of gun deaths is gang, quote-unquote gang violence, but basically retaliatory violence between social sets that are seeking, that have no like course of vindication for law, there is a robust panoply of activist groups that are doing this. So for one example, masks, Mothers Against Senseless Killing, I think, or looking into what the Mothers of the Movement, which is an organization of people who've been killed, mothers of various high-profile young black men and women who've been killed by vigilantes or police are doing, like, there are church groups that will do things like, you know, patrolling the streets at night and talking to people, which actually surprisingly has a real effect. There are there are a variety of church groups that will also do things like gang outreach, general, some of them not involving the police, which is particularly helpful, where they're like, you know who the young men are in your neighborhood who are likely to commit an act of violence, and when you hear through the grapevine that there is something that has happened for which they're going to retaliate, someone from the church calls them up and says, do you really want to do this? And that stops it. That doesn't necessarily involve the police. That doesn't necessarily involve your local senator, and it doesn't involve the Democratic Party, but it actually can be meaningful. And so a good place to go if you're in an urban setting is to find out what the local churches, specifically the black churches, are doing. Now, if you're in a more rural space, likely the most leading drivers of gun deaths are suicides and domestic violence. There, again, there are surprising activist groups and surprising coalitions that are emerging. So, for example, in New Hampshire and in Kentucky, there's something called the Gun Shop Project, which is actually gun store owners talking to people who come into their shops, being like, they've been trained by medical professionals to look for signs of people who are near suicide, and then all they do is ask them, do you really want to buy this gun, or do you want me to hold it a couple days? And that has been demonstrated to actually lower suicide rates. Now, again, like, it's weird because it's like a lot of people are like, oh, my God, gun shop owners, they're icky. And sure, like, you can feel that way. But at the point at which this person is taking a sobbing woman or man away from the counter, being like, you don't need this right now. How about you come into the back, have a cup of coffee, and we call your doctor? That's a real intervention.
Right? Uh-huh.
And so that's happening. Likewise, then there's some similar, I can provide some link for some similar stuff that's happening, too, in terms of domestic violence as well. So the trick is to sort of, like, look to where the people are, rather than taking your notes from the national level stuff, look to where people are suffering locally, and there you'll also find helpers who are trying to deal with it. And the trick is, again, if you're not necessarily buying into the, like, pro-gun, anti-gun frame, which is focusing on the people being hurt, you're going to find some surprising allies. And that may not be the same. That won't necessarily change things nationally, but it will make a difference where you are. But I should also say, like, there is some room for straight-up voting and for calling your senators and for all that. But, like, the trick is, there's a way in which this is, like, when mass shootings happen, they're a trap. Like, obviously, they're not saying they're false flags. They're very, very real. But I'm saying that discursively, politically, we have this immense desire to do something in reaction to them that feels emotionally proportional to the horror that they've given us, right? And when you see 60 people dead, it's understandable emotionally to be like, I want to take down all those guns, and I want to melt them into the biggest statue ever. Like, that's fine. But there is a way in which, given how the news cycle works and given the way in which, like, parties make money, whether they be the parties like the Democratic Party or the Republicans or parties like the NRA in the smaller piece sense, simply embracing that impulse actually just perpetuates the same sort of status quo. So the actual reality is that there are a ton of things that can, again, lower gun deaths that are not necessarily the same as gun control. So, for example, the need for triage centers. In Chicago, on the east side of Chicago, there have been activists who have been able to create, like basically you need what's called a level one trauma center in order to vastly increase the likelihood that people who have been shot are just not going to bleed out. And that is an investment of money and infrastructure that has to come from some sort of governmental body, and that's something that people can fight for. Ditto, too, there are various national-level programs that will do that type, that will foster that type of gang intervention stuff. You know, you evaluate them individually as you get to them because they do involve some relation to the police. But there are things that the trick is, too, if you want to create national-level change on this, you need to, unfortunately, check your very understandable desire for single dramatic gestures in favor of viewing the broader phenomena of gun violence as a disparate collection of individual at-risk groups, each of whom can be helped with different targeted interventions. Which is sexy. It's not like something that, like, again, like, you're not going to see people with signs being like, different specific targeted interventions against gun violence now, but that's actually what's going to fix it in a way that simply being like, ban all guns is not. That said, we do need a political, like, if politics is in this weird way, in this depressing space, the art of the possible, that's constrained. The art of the possible is constrained. The horizon of possibility is constrained by the horizon of what's imaginability. And there is the fact that we don't have a lot of voices out there being like, ban all guns, immediately moves the discourse rightwards and move the discourse towards people, you know, the status quo not changing. So if there aren't people who want to go out there and be like, ban all guns, you know, I may not agree with you, but like, that is something that will help shape the discourse and make it more robust and meaningful rather than just the tired sort of cycle it is.
And it is a tired cycle. I mean, I think, you know, I guess one of the, to wrap up, I think the thing that, you know, we would say is that, you know, when we point out the structural causes of this, they are the same structural causes that lead to us not having a universal healthcare system. They are the same structural causes that are, you know, causing all sorts of the inequalities that we live with every day. And so to deal with everything, to deal with gun violence, again, sort of big air quotes around that every time we talk about it as an issue, we have to deal with inequality on micro and macro levels, from the fact that the South Side of Chicago didn't have a level one trauma center to the fact that, you know, we don't have a functioning healthcare system in this country, and the Las Vegas, you know, officials are setting up a GoFundMe to help the people who were shot in this moment, right?
And it is a way in which where it's like, it's understandably morally frustrating that on this issue, I wind up finding the exact same depressing structures that we otherwise confront. And the realization that there are no simple and easy answers, but there are answers that require work and time and affect. But on some level, like, why would we expect otherwise? Right? There's a way in which the expectation for radical change within the system is just a way of, the system's never going to accommodate that. And so, you know, and don't get me wrong, I'll show up for the dictatorship of the proletariat that's going to eliminate gun violence through, like, income redistribution.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
But after that, we need to have something that's other than just a sort of, like, a knee-jerk affective utopianism that just gets hijacked in the favor of a really deadening status quo.
And on that note, how can people keep up with you?
I'm on Twitter, at Pat Blanchfield. Yeah, I've got links there. Yeah, freelance. So, you know, I got a site that's Cart Blanchfield with an E and then my last name. It's a good pun. Not mine, someone else's. But yeah, I am a deep admirer of your podcast and of your work and deeply simpatico with your audience. So anyone who wants to follow me on that space there or both those spaces is more than welcome. I'd love to have you.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.